This is Audible.
Audible, Inc. presents The Ultimate Harry Potter and Philosophy, Hogwarts for Muggles, written by Gregory Basham and William Irwin, narrated by Susan Duwerden.
Forward. Tom Morris. In 2004, there was an important literary event involving Harry Potter that didn't require sleepy parents to show up before midnight at bookstores around the world, with hyperactive, well-costumed children trembling in anticipation of a new adventure and completely unable to sleep. It didn't involve J.K. Rowling writing something new, or even leaving her home for a special appearance, and it never sparked front-page newspaper headlines or special television news bulletins. It was the surprising publication of an unexpected book, Harry Potter and Philosophy, If Aristotle Ran Hogwarts, edited by the philosophers David Baggett and Sean Klein. What made this a remarkable occurrence for Harry and his fans and the broader world of readers is that it demonstrated the range and depth of attention this ongoing story was receiving, not only among kids, teens, and imaginative young adults, but also throughout the professional ranks of the academic world. The wizards of wisdom in our colleges and universities were taking note of Harry's remarkable story and were finding in it great ideas and lessons for life. Courage, duplicity, friendship, happiness, justice, love and ambition joined issues of good, evil, death and freedom, among many other topics, in this remarkable examination of themes to be found in the adventures of Harry Potter as they unfolded before us, book after book. When I was initially asked to write an essay for that first collective philosophical look at the deeper themes in the Potter tales, I must admit that I was simply perplexed. At the time, I wasn't a Potter reader. I thought these were just books for kids. But after one of the editors of the project vigorously assured me that the Harry Potter stories were for everyone and were enthralling people of all ages around the globe, I cracked open the first volume, mainly out of curiosity, and then, like many adults before me, was instantly hooked. In no time at all, whenever I prepared to sit down to read, I felt a strange urge to dress up in black robes and a tall pointed hat. I breezed through the first four volumes, which were then the only ones in print, and subsequently began to read each one again, slowly, while awaiting the new books, savouring the intricacies of the story and the sparks of wisdom I started to see everywhere. By the time the series was complete, I had read most of the seven large volumes six times through, and with deeper insights as my reward each time. There was much more going on in Harry's world than met the casual glance, and far beyond the hidden skullduggery and secret machinations of the many characters. Ideas were percolating under the surface. Real wisdom was suffused throughout the pages. The former classics major, Joanne Rowling, was not merely a masterful storyteller, but was also a talented weaver of profound perspectives on some of the things that matter most in our lives. I was inspired. I quickly wrote an essay on what I saw as one of Harry Potter's central attributes, his courage, and then could not stop writing. In no time at all, I had written an entire book of my own, examining the philosophical insights to be found in these incredible stories that were linking the generations like perhaps nothing else in our time. I had to wrap up my book and send it in for publication right after Rowling's sixth volume of her planned seven installments came out. So I ended up holding my philosophical breath for a good while in anticipation of the concluding storyline and what it would say about my take on the earlier books. I'm happy to report that I was able to breathe a great sigh of relief when the series ended and all of my major interpretations had held up. But I had not had the last word as a philosopher on Harry and his friends. This exciting new book that you now have before you, The Ultimate Harry Potter and Philosophy, Hogwarts for Muggles, is a fresh and distinctive report on the great ideas in the series. All of the authors of the chapters have had the advantage of thinking through their chosen issues and writing up their conclusions after the entire Potter storyline was complete, and Rowling had even had her say in public about things that never made it into the pages of the official texts. The philosophers and other top Harry Potter experts who are gathered together here offer new voices and new perspectives on many of the most important ideas that come up in the books, some of which can be genuinely life-changing. Reading this book will be like putting on a philosophical decoder ring. It will show you vital aspects of the deepest story that lies behind these famous novels. The dust has settled and the air has cleared. The great battle is over, and the surviving characters have gone on with their lives. It's time to take stock and cast a long view over the most remarkable literary phenomenon of our time, and to see what it says about some of the ultimate issues we face in our lives. As you read these pages and personally grapple with their important issues, you will experience anew the real magic that will forever animate J.K. Rowling's immortal tales. Introduction. Harry Potter and the Enchantment of Philosophy. Let's play a little word association game. What comes to mind when you hear the word philosophy? Deep, dense, complex. In short, heavy stuff, right? So, what's the connection between philosophy and the Potter books and films? How can there be any real philosophy, or any good philosophy, in fantasy works aimed primarily at kids? Easy. Philosophy, as Plato said, begins in wonder. And kids wonder about everything. They're naturally curious, questioning, and eager to learn. Often, they understand a lot more than adults give them credit for. That's why J.K. Rowling, like J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and other great children's writers, doesn't hesitate to raise complex issues and pose challenging questions. Of course, Rowling realizes that most of her readers won't grasp all of the subtleties and complexities of the issues she raises. But she also knows that young readers, like Fang gnawing on a large, meaty dragon bone, can get a great deal of nourishment from foods they can't completely digest. This book is for Rowling fans who want to explore some of the deeper issues posed in the Potter books and films. What is love? Is it, as Rowling says, the most powerful magic of all? Is there an afterlife? If so, what might it be like? Is death something to be feared? Or mastered, as Harry ultimately was able to do? Do people have souls? If so, how are they related to their bodies? Can souls, if they exist, be divided, as Voldemort fragmented his by means of the Horcruxes? What can shapeshifters like Animagi and Bogarts teach us about personal identity and the self? Does power inevitably corrupt? Is Hogwarts a model school, or are there real shortcomings with the education students receive there? Is it true, as Albus Dumbledore says, that our choices reveal far more about us than our abilities do? What can the complex and intriguing character of Severus Snape teach us about moral conflict, character judgment, and the possibility of redemption? Would it ever be ethical to use a love potion? Is it true, as Kingsley Shacklebolt proclaims, that every human life is worth the same? Is it true, as Dumbledore says, that something can be real, even if it exists only inside a person's head? This is a book written for Potter fans, by Potter fans, most of whom happen to be professional philosophers in their 9-to-5 lives. Like other volumes in the Blackwell Philosophy and Pop Culture series, it uses popular culture, in this case, the Potter books and films, as a hook to teach and popularize the ideas of the great thinkers. Some of the chapters explore the philosophy of the Potter books, the basic values and the big picture assumptions that underlie the series, while others use themes from the books as a way to discuss various philosophical ideas and perspectives. Like others involved in the popular culture and philosophy movement, our hope is to bring philosophy out of the ivied halls of academia and make its methods, resources, and critical spirit available to all. Several of the philosophers who contributed to this book also contributed to Harry Potter and Philosophy. Chicago, Open Court, 2004, co-edited by David Baggett and Sean E. Klein. In some ways, this book is a follow-up to that earlier volume. The earlier book covered only the first 5 volumes in the Potter series. Some of it, therefore, was guesswork, because many of the important revelations and plot developments occur only in the last 2 books of the series. This volume covers the entire 7-book saga, and focuses particularly on developments in the climactic final two books. So, the wait is over. The faculty has assembled for one last time. The great hall, ablaze with light, is buzzing with excitement, and the long wooden tables groan with the delectable things to eat. Once more, it's time to don your robes, take a generous nip of Baruffio's brain elixir, and prepare for a philosophical feast. It's going to be a great year. All references to the Harry Potter novels are taken from the following American editions published by Scholastic, Inc. in New York. Sorcerer's Stone, 1998. Chamber of Secrets, 1999. Prisoner of Azkaban, 1999. Goblet of Fire, 2000. Order of the Phoenix, 2003. Half-Blood Prince, 2005. Deathly Hallows, 2007. Part 1. The Horcrux of the Matter. Destiny, Identity, and the Soul. Chapter 1. The Soul in Harry Potter. Scott Seahorn. Souls play a huge part in the Harry Potter saga. At different points in the books, Harry, Sirius Black, and Dudley Dursley narrowly avoid having their souls sucked out by Dementors. Barty Crouch Jr. does not escape this fate, and notoriously, Lord Voldemort intentionally creates 6 Horcruxes, and unintentionally creates a 7th in Harry, thereby dividing his own soul into 8 parts, all of which must be destroyed before Voldemort can die. So, what is the soul? In Harry's world, people have souls that generally survive bodily death. But it is not entirely obvious how souls work and what their nature is. Over the centuries, philosophers and theologians have proposed and debated various accounts of the soul. In this chapter, we'll survey some of those accounts before turning to the questions of how souls work in J.K. Rowling's books, and whether her picture of the soul is plausible. Philosophical conceptions of the soul. While competing conceptions of the soul are legion, we'll focus here on 5 different philosophical views. The life source view. According to some ancient Greek philosophers, the soul accounts for life itself. In this view, the essential difference between living and non-living things is that living things have a soul and non-living things do not. Yet, because the lowest animals and even plants are alive, this means that all plants and animals have souls. Last-ended scroots and even gillyweed would have souls, according to this view. These days, not too many people think that this conception of the soul is correct. The sentience view. According to a second conception, the soul is responsible for sentience, the ability some organisms have to feel pleasure and pain and sense the world around them. If an organism is consciously aware of its surroundings, then the organism feels. It has experiences. According to the sentience view, the soul is responsible for sentience, along with all higher-level thought. Plants, one assumes, do not have sentient awareness, and so, in this conception, would not have souls. Of course, in the universe of Harry Potter, some magical plants, like the Whomping Willow, do have some direct sensation of the world, and would thus have souls. The Cartesian view. A third view of the soul further narrows the scope of ensouled organisms. According to a view associated with the philosopher René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, the soul is not responsible for sensation and awareness. Descartes thought that those features of mental life could be accounted for by purely material causes. However, he believed that mere material causes would never be able to explain our ability to use language and formulate complex beliefs. For this, we need souls. So Descartes said that our immaterial soul is responsible only for higher-level cognitive functions, including beliefs, desires, and, especially, our ability to use language. One consequence of the Cartesian view is that non-human animals do not have souls, at least if those animals lack linguistic ability and higher-level thought. Descartes was willing to accept this and thought that non-human animals were entirely soulless. Some of the magical creatures in the Harry Potter stories might blur this distinction within the Cartesian view. For instance, owls seem to understand human speech, although they don't speak in return, and magical pets like Crookshanks seem much more intelligent than your average cat. According to the life source, sentience and Cartesian views, the soul is usually thought to be some sort of immaterial substance, something not made of matter but still associated with or connected to a person's material body. If souls are in fact like that, then there is a possibility that the soul could survive a person's bodily death. On the other hand, there are many philosophers and scientists who would deny the existence of a soul, if what we mean by a soul is some sort of entity independent of the brain and the body. This leads to a fourth view of the soul, materialism. Materialism. Materialists hold that ultimately there is nothing but matter and physical forces. All mental functioning, including language and emotions, is due to physical processes in the brain, and there simply is no extra entity above and beyond this. Needless to say, according to a materialist view, there is no life after death. With bodily death, the processes that underlie our mental and emotional life simply cease, and that's all there is to it. The sentimental view. In everyday talk, the word soul is often used in a way that does not clearly correspond with any of the more abstract conceptions just discussed. From the Hoagy Carmichael tune, we have Heart and soul, I fell in love with you. Heart and soul, the way a fool would do, madly. Or we might speak of a person seeking his or her soulmate. We talk of people having good souls. We might describe music or art as soulful or as soulless. These sorts of everyday sentimentalist uses of the word soul need not be taken to imply any particular metaphysical view. That is, they don't commit one to any view on which the soul is an actual substance, existing independently of the body. If we say, unlike her later work, the artist's early paintings were soulless, clearly we are not suggesting that the artist literally lacked and then later somehow obtained an immaterial soul. Rather, we are suggesting that the artist's early work was uninspired or somehow lacked genuine emotional depth. Or if I say that I love her, heart and soul, or that we are soulmates, I am commenting about the emotional depth of my attachment and the deep connection we feel for each other. If we say that someone has bared her soul, we mean she has let us see through the superficial trappings and down to what is most deeply important to her. These uses of the word soul are essentially metaphorical ways of talking about that which makes us most human and makes life most full, our deepest emotions, our ability to love, our moral conscience. Materialist philosophers don't need to renounce any of these ways of talking, and certainly don't need to go back and translate Hoagy Carmichael's lyrics into some sort of thesis about brain states. Sea fibers firing, I fell in love with you. With these sundry options on the table, we are now ready to turn to Harry Potter and try to place the conception of the soul as developed in the story. To foreshadow, we'll see that Rowling's picture of the soul is an interesting mix of views. In many ways, it seems that her conception of the soul is closest to the sentimental view, but she combines it with a metaphysics that incorporates part of the Cartesian and sentience views. Ghosts and going on. Materialism is the dominant view among philosophers and scientists in our world today, but materialism is false in the world of Harry Potter, where souls typically survive bodily death. Here is Hermione Granger's explanation of souls.
Look, if I picked up a sword right now, Ron, and ran you through with it, I wouldn't damage your soul at all.
Which would be a real comfort to me, I'm sure, said Ron.
Harry laughed.
It should be, actually. But my point is that whatever happens to your body, your soul will survive, untouched, said Hermione.
So we know that in Rowling's world, the soul survives destruction of the body. Beyond the fact of survival, it's not entirely clear what happens to the soul of a deceased person. In Order of the Phoenix, in the room at the Ministry of Magic where Sirius dies, there is a mysterious archway with a veil, and both Harry and Luna Lovegood hear voices from beyond the veil. Luna's interpretation is that dead people exist just beyond, and that we will see them again. Later, Nearly Headless Nick tells Harry that the recently killed Sirius will have gone on, but he has no further light to shed on what happens in the ordinary case. Nick, of course, is a ghost, and he explains to Harry that a wizard is able to avoid going on by remaining behind as a ghostly imprint of his former self. He says that few wizards choose this path, and perhaps it is not too hard to see why. Nick lives on, sort of, in a ghostly imitation of a body, one that can see and be seen, hear and be heard, but that otherwise walks through walls and has few physical effects. Rowling's ghosts apparently induce an icy sensation when a person has contact with them, and Moaning Myrtle is somehow able to make splashes in toilets, but beyond this, they seem to mostly lack bodily effects. Voldemort presumably could have had this sort of immortality all along, but it is a form of immortality devoid of real physical contact, and, more important for Voldemort, devoid of power. Besides being a ghost, there are several other ways in which souls can appear on Earth after their bodies have died. First, there is the case of Voldemort himself, who, because of his Horcruxes, survives bodily death when his killing curse aimed at baby Harry backfires. We'll talk more about Horcruxes later, but at this point, it is worth noting that when Voldemort's soul continues, it is in an incredibly weak form. He later describes his condition at the time as less than spirit, less than the meanest ghost. In that state, Voldemort needs to attach himself to a living body to have any physical effects at all. Second, there is the semi-ghostly condition in which Harry twice sees his departed loved ones. In the graveyard scene in Goblet of Fire, Cedric Diggory, Bertha Jorkins, Frank Bryce, and Harry's parents appear out of Voldemort's wand. These ghostly figures look to Harry much more solid than ordinary ghosts, and they have enough of a physical presence that James Potter tells Harry that they will give him some time to escape once the wand connection is broken. Similarly, when Harry uses the Resurrection Stone in Deathly Hallows, he sees Sirius, Remus Lupin, and his parents, and it seems that they are again, at least in some sense, real. Less substantial than living bodies, and here only temporarily, they are nonetheless not mere ghosts. They are described as neither ghost nor truly flesh. So, it seems that although souls normally go on in some undescribed way, disembodied souls can stay or return to Earth in certain circumstances, and when they do, they take one of a variety of forms, ranging from Voldemort's almost entirely non-physical state to Nick's ghostly state, to the temporary but slightly more substantial physical states of the souls brought back by the Resurrection Stone. All of this would be impossible if materialism were true. So, materialism is false within the Potter universe. But to learn more about the nature of souls, we need to consider Dementors and Horcruxes. The Dementor's Kiss. Dementors suck good feelings and happy memories out of people. Worse than that, they can destroy your soul, as Lupin explains to Harry. You see, the Dementor lowers its hood only to use its last and worst weapon. What's that? They call it the Dementor's Kiss, said Lupin with a slightly twisted smile. It's what Dementors do to those they wish to destroy utterly. I suppose there must be some kind of mouth under there, because they clamp their jaws upon the mouth of the victim, and suck out his soul. What? They kill? Oh, no, said Lupin. Much worse than that. You can exist without your soul, you know, as long as your brain and heart are still working. But you'll have no sense of self anymore, no memory, no anything. There's no chance at all of recovery. You'll just exist as an empty shell. And your soul is gone forever. Lost. This is very interesting. A wizard's soul normally survives bodily death, and the natural further assumption would be that souls are immortal. But with Dementors around, not all souls achieve this happy state, for Dementors can apparently destroy souls completely. You can still exist, even without your soul, however. Lupin's words here are open to more than one interpretation. He might merely mean your body can still exist and keep functioning biologically as long as your organs are still intact. According to this reading, the Dementor's kiss would leave the victim in something like a permanent vegetative state, in which basic metabolic functions continue, but in which there is no substantial mental life at all. Yet, if this is what Lupin means, it's odd that he portrays it as the continued existence of the person, but in a state worse than death. If the soul is the source of all conscious mental life, and if all of that disappears after the Dementor's kiss, then it would seem more appropriate to say that the person truly is no more, that the empty shell of a body is just that, a body, but not a person. Because Lupin is insistent that a person can continue to exist without a soul, a different picture seems to be suggested. This is speculative, but here's my guess. A soulless person still has sensations, and even thoughts about the passing show. After the kiss was applied, Barty Crouch Jr. may have still recognized that there were people in the room, but he had no idea who they were or who he was, for he had no substantial memory or sense of self. Accordingly, perhaps we should think of existence after the Dementor's kiss as akin to a severe case of dementia or Alzheimer's disease, perhaps similar to the condition Lockhart found himself in after one of his memory charms backfired. The Dementor's kiss would appear to rule out at least two, if not three, of the remaining conceptions of the soul. If one can be alive without one's soul, then the soul cannot be the source of life itself. So the life source view cannot be correct. And if a victim of the Dementor's kiss still has sensations, and even a body in a vegetative state may be somewhat responsive to sensory stimuli, then the sentience view also seems ruled out. Moreover, if the Dementor's kiss does allow someone to think, feel, and notice the passing show, albeit lacking memories or a sense of self, then even the Cartesian view seems unlikely. According to the Cartesian view, the soul is that which is responsible for our higher level functions, our ability to have beliefs, and, especially, to understand language. In the interpretation I have suggested, the kiss might leave those abilities at least partially intact, despite the soul itself being utterly destroyed. Horcruxes. A central plot element for the Harry Potter story as a whole is Tom Riddle's quest to defeat death using Horcruxes. Professor Horace Slughorn explains to a young Riddle what happens when a wizard creates a Horcrux.
"Well, you split your soul, you see," said Slughorn, "and hide part of it in an object outside the body. Then, even if one's body is attacked or destroyed, one cannot die, for part of the soul remains earthbound and undamaged."
Indeed, later, when Voldemort attacks the infant Harry using the Avada Kedavra curse that rebounds, then destroys Voldemort's body, Voldemort himself remains alive, albeit as less than spirit, less than the meanest ghost. The young Riddle presses Slughorn further and asks how one splits one's soul. Slughorn answers,
"By an act of evil, the supreme act of evil, by committing murder. Killing rips the soul apart. The wizard intent upon creating a Horcrux would use the damage to his advantage. He would encase the torn portion."
Slughorn does not answer Riddle's further question about exactly how one encases the soul, other than saying that there is a spell. Riddle then asks,
"Can you only split your soul once? Wouldn't it be better, make you stronger, to have your soul in more pieces? I mean, for instance, isn't 7 the most powerfully magic number? Wouldn't 7?
Slughorn is horrified that Riddle would apparently think of killing repeatedly to do this, but he also warns against it for another reason. He has already told Riddle that the soul is supposed to remain intact and whole, and that splitting it is an act of violation. It is against nature. 2 points from Slughorn's words are worth emphasizing. First, that it requires a supreme act of evil to make the soul such that it can be ripped. And second, that the soul is thereby damaged or made unstable, and that ripping it more than once presumably increases the damage. This is a point that Hermione makes as well, after she read Secrets of the Darkest Art, which, along with other dark magic books, she summoned from Dumbledore's office after his death.
"And the more I've read about Horcruxes," said Hermione, "the more horrible they seem, and the less I can believe that he actually made 6. It warns in this book how unstable you make the rest of your soul by ripping it, and that's just by making 1 Horcrux."
Although both Slughorn and Secrets of the Darkest Art are clear that ripping the soul damages it, it is not immediately obvious how the damage to the soul translates into harm to the living human being. There is, after all, no indication that Voldemort's mental faculties or magical abilities are in any way diminished. Indeed, Dumbledore warns Harry, "Never forget, though, that while his soul may be damaged beyond repair, his brain and his magical powers remain intact. It will take uncommon skill and power to kill a wizard like Voldemort, even without his Horcruxes." This seems quite clear to rule out the Cartesian view, according to which the soul is responsible for all higher-level thought. If a Cartesian soul were horribly damaged, then one's thoughts, skills, and presumably magical abilities would be damaged as well. But all of this is left intact in Voldemort. Because Voldemort's sensory abilities seem unharmed too, despite his damaged soul, it seems that the sentience view is also excluded. Rather than applying the Cartesian or sentience views, Rowling adopts the sentimental view of the soul, according to which the soul is associated with that which makes us most human, with our capacity to love and our moral conscience. This was already suggested by the fact that one rips and damages the soul by committing the supremely evil act of murder. If the soul is associated with what makes us deeply human and good, then it at least makes poetic sense that the soul would be damaged by committing the ultimate evil. The key evidence lies in what seemed different about Voldemort after he damaged his soul so badly. Not his higher cognitive functions, but his humanity. Dumbledore tells Harry,
"Lord Voldemort has seemed to grow less human with the passing years, and the transformation he has undergone seemed to me to be only explicable if his soul was mutilated beyond the realms of what we might call usual evil."
Specifically, after ripping his soul and creating Horcruxes, the handsome young Tom Riddle undergoes a significant physical transformation. Few of us look better as we age, but with Riddle Voldemort, the change is extreme. In Goblet of Fire, when he has completely regained his body in the graveyard, he is described as whiter than a skull, with wide, livid scarlet eyes, and a nose that was flat as a snake's, with slits for nostrils. Voldemort's change in appearance is Rowling's metaphor for what was happening to Voldemort on a deep emotional and moral level. Of course, the child Riddle in the orphanage already had a significantly sinister side to him, and there is no evidence that he ever truly loved anyone. But in his early days at Hogwarts, he at least had the ability to charm people. He was a leader among his peers, even among older students, and he accomplished this through personality rather than fear. He charmed Professor Slughorn, who predicted that Riddle would become Minister of Magic, and managed to get him to discuss Horcruxes, which was a banned topic at Hogwarts. By the time Riddle begins his reign of terror as Lord Voldemort, however, all indications are that Death Eaters continue to follow him out of fear, rather than because of anything remotely approximating devotion. Even Bellatrix Lestrange, his most devoted follower near the end, seems worshipful of his power, but hardly charmed. That capacity, Riddle's most human attribute, seems to have utterly disappeared after his soul was ripped into 7 pieces. 8, if you count Harry as the 7th Horcrux. Voldemort might have been able to repair his damaged soul, but not by use of a potion or an appropriate incantation, not even with the Elder Wand. Rather, according to Secrets of the Darkest Art, a ripped soul can perhaps be repaired through remorse. As Hermione puts it, you've got to really feel what you've done. In none of the other views of the soul would there be any reason for the particular emotion of remorse to have a special effect on the immaterial soul. But according to the sentimental view, the soul is most closely connected with our deepest emotions and our moral conscience. Our goodness and humanity are damaged by evil actions, but we can go some ways toward restoring that goodness and humanity if we feel genuine remorse. In the climactic scene, Harry, in fact, suggests to Voldemort that he be a man and try to feel some remorse. Voldemort, of course, having gone so far beyond even the usual evil, feels no inclination toward remorse. And Voldemort is finally killed when his own killing curse, shot from the Elder Wand of which Harry is the master, rebounds off Harry's Expelliarmus. A plausible view? If Rowling indeed adopts the sentimental conception of the soul, she does so with an interesting twist. The sentimental view is not a philosophical theory developed by theologians or philosophers, but rather a distillation of various ways we use the word soul. These ordinary uses of the word could easily be taken as metaphorical and do not necessarily imply that there really is some sort of independent and immaterial entity that explains our deepest emotional commitments and moral conscience. Even materialists can and do use the word soul as a perfectly good metaphor. But within the Harry Potter universe, Rowling clearly also presupposes a metaphysical view, that the soul is independent of the body, is not harmed by normal physical events, and can even survive the destruction of the body. In other words, Rowling takes the metaphysical picture normally associated with the more philosophical views of the soul, especially the sentience view and the Cartesian view, and combines it with the metaphorical picture suggested by the sentimental view. So, does Rowling offer a theory of the soul that is likely to be true? Probably not, but the issues are contentious. First, many philosophers and scientists plausibly argue that there is no good evidence for the existence of an immaterial substance that is causally responsible for anything above and beyond what the human body does. It would be possible to have such evidence someday. If neuroscientists saw that there were events that happened in brains with no observable physical cause, then this would at least be an indication that the events had an immaterial cause. But we have not seen any such brain events up to now. Moreover, philosophers have pointed out for centuries that it is difficult to see how an immaterial soul would even be able to interact with a purely material body. If the soul is not made of matter and does not have physical properties, then it is mysterious how it could cause the human body to move, or how anything in the material world would have any effect on it. This kind of dualism of mind and body would be outside anything of which we have experience. Dualism is not incoherent, and it is possible that it is correct, but it faces substantial obstacles. Finally, Rowling's combination of an implausible metaphysics with the sentimental view of the soul probably makes the problems worse rather than better. It is especially implausible that there would be an immaterial part of us that is specifically responsible for only our deepest emotions and moral traits, but not for other psychological capacities. These traits may seem linked to us because they are arguably what makes us most human, but from the standpoint of scientific psychology, there is nothing that is so different in kind here. So there seems to be no need to postulate something altogether different from the brain to explain these traits. In addition, as mentioned earlier, within the story, the immaterial soul can sometimes remain on Earth with a variety of different physical powers or presences, depending on whether the soul is here as a ghost, as something conjured by the resurrection stone, or as a bare soul saved from destruction by a Horcrux. If, as we've seen, it would be difficult to explain how an immaterial soul could interact at all with the physical world, then it would be even more difficult to explain why the soul would have different physical abilities depending on what magic spell is at work. Of course, the implausibility of Rowling's metaphysics is not a strike against her work of fiction. After all, it is also extremely unlikely that there are witches, wizards, and magic in the real world. And Rowling's picture of the soul does have a way of making vivid what we care about, or what we hope we care about. Besides, talk of souls, horcruxes, dementors and magic makes for a terrific story, and that's reason enough. Chapter 2. Sirius Black. Man or Dog. Eric Seidel. Imagine yourself virtually imprisoned, cooped up inside, unable to go outdoors for several months. Now, finally, you get to go outside. You're free to do anything you want. You can run around, enjoy the fresh air, go to a movie, do whatever you wish. What would you do? Now, suppose you had a tail. Would you do anything different? Would you run around in circles trying to bite your tail? Neither would I. Oddly enough, this is exactly what Sirius Black does in Order of the Phoenix when he transforms into a dog in order to escort Harry to the Hogwarts Express at the beginning of the school year. And he does it because he's excited to be outside. Or so J.K. Rowling tells us. This behaviour strikes me as so strange that I'd ask Sirius about it if I could. Unfortunately, I can't, as Sirius is no longer alive. So I'll have to try to answer this question using the tools of philosophy. Fortunately, even though most philosophers are muggles, we can use the same skills of rational analysis that enabled Albus Dumbledore to discover the 12 uses of dragon's blood. So, let's push on. Chasing his tail wouldn't be so strange if Sirius were a dog. But he's not a dog. He's a man in a dog's body. Or is he? How can we best describe Sirius? As a man who is sometimes in a dog's body and sometimes in a man's body. As a dog who is sometimes in a man's body and sometimes in a dog's body. Or as someone who is sometimes a dog and sometimes a man. If the answer is the last, then what is that someone who stays the same while Sirius changes between being a dog and being a man? Sirius is not the only one who transforms in the Potter series. During the course of the 7 books, we come into contact with other animagi, Peter Pettigrew, Rita Skeeter, Professor McGonagall, as well as werewolves, Remus Lupin and Fenrir Greyback, Bogarts, and the frequent use of Polyjuice Potion. Several Transformers behave in odd and sometimes illuminating ways. For example, a transformed Lupin would attack Harry, Ron Weasley and Hermione Granger, and as Mad-Eye Moody, Barty Crouch Jr. is one of the best Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers Harry ever has, even going beyond the call of duty to teach Harry to resist the Imperious Curse. Why do they do these odd things? This is a question about their identities, about what makes them who they are. It is also a question about the relationship between one's mind and one's body. It seems obvious that Padfoot's body is a dog's body, but is his mind a dog's mind, or a man's mind? Let's see whether we can answer these questions. The path we follow will be full of twists and turns, like a snitch trying to avoid a seeker. But if we keep our eye on the gold, we should be able to catch it. Mind-body distinctions. When Sirius transforms into a dog, sometimes he acts as if he's a man, and other times he acts as if he's a dog. Why does the transformed person sometimes act as if he is his normal self, and other times act as if he is the person or the animal he has transformed into? Answering this question requires us to understand just what a transformed person is. Put simply, when Sirius transforms, does he become a dog, or is he still a man? Both of these options are too crude. Sirius transformed is not merely a dog. A dog would not do many of the things that Padfoot does. For example, standing on his hind legs, putting his forelegs on Harry's shoulders, and looking Harry in the eye when Harry goes off to school in Order of the Phoenix. Nor is Padfoot still a man. Many of the things Padfoot does, for example, chasing his tail, are more appropriate for a dog than for Sirius. The transformed person isn't wholly the object he's transformed into, or wholly the person he was before he transformed. Obviously, then, the answer is that Padfoot is part man and part dog. Since the time of René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, who is generally considered to be the father of modern philosophy, There has been a natural way to think of how people might be divided. We think of each individual as being made up of two distinct parts, namely, a mind and a body. So perhaps when we say that Padfoot is part Sirius and part dog, we mean that he has the mind of one of them and the body of the other. There are four possibilities here. 1. Padfoot has the mind of Sirius and the body of a dog. 2. Padfoot has the mind of a dog and the body of a dog. 3. Padfoot has the mind of Sirius and the body of Sirius. 4. Padfoot has the mind of a dog and the body of Sirius. The last two options would seem to be non-starters. We can tell by looking at Padfoot that he doesn't have the body of Sirius. He looks nothing like Sirius, or any other man for that matter. But this dismissal is too superficial. If Padfoot doesn't have Sirius's body, then what happens to Sirius's body when he transforms? Where does it go? It's all very well for Professor McGonagall to assert that vanished objects go into non-being, which is to say, everything. But it seems implausible that Sirius's body will go into non-being when he transforms into Padfoot, and then will come out of non-being when he transforms back. What's more plausible is that Sirius's body itself changes. Before he transforms, it is the physical body of a man, and afterward, it is the body of a dog. But it is the same physical stuff, somehow rearranged. That is, if the body has an effect on what Padfoot does, the effect isn't going to come from his having Sirius's human body. Because even if Padfoot does literally have Sirius's body, it is physically the body of a dog. What of the other two options? Both are problematic for similar reasons. Why, if Padfoot has the mind of Sirius, does he chase his tail? And why, if he has the mind of a dog, does he stand on his hind legs at King's Cross Station? Mrs. Weasley chastises him, hissing, "For heaven's sake, act more like a dog, Sirius!" These are the questions with which we started. Thinking about Padfoot as divided between mind and body doesn't get us anywhere. Whose reasons? Sirius has no reason to chase his tail, but perhaps Padfoot does. When Lupin is human, he has no reason to attack his students, but perhaps when he's a werewolf, he does have reason to do so. Perhaps it would be helpful to recast our inquiries in terms of reasons. Thus, we might wonder not whether the mind involved is Sirius's or Padfoot's, but whether the reasons causing the action are Sirius's or Padfoot's. This sort of strategy is a good one. Usually, asking specific questions rather than general questions will yield answers that are helpful rather than vague. For that reason, asking questions about reasons rather than about minds is likely to provide more interesting answers. Unfortunately, no sooner do I make the suggestion than I start to see problems. First, the answer to this question seems to lead us in the wrong direction. If anyone has reason to chase his tail, it's Padfoot, not Sirius. But surely, if anything of Sirius is left after he becomes a dog, it would be his reasons for acting. It would be bizarre to say that in transforming, one loses one's reasons for acting. One transforms, presumably, as a means of achieving one's goals, as an expression of one's reasons. If transforming were to cause you to no longer act to achieve your goals, why would you ever transform? We can see this more clearly in considering some of the examples of Polyjuice transformation. We expect the transformed individual to act for his or her reasons, not for those of the being he transformed into. This is indeed what we find. If the shape one takes when one transforms is the source of one's reasons for acting, then we might have expected Harry and Ron to act to achieve whatever goals Crabbe and Goyle have when Harry and Ron transform in Chamber of Secrets. But they don't. They act for their own reasons. Similarly, when they transform in Deathly Hallows, Harry transforms into Albert Runcorn, a Death Eater, and Ron transforms into Reginald Catamole, a man whose wife is on trial for stealing magic. Runcorn and Catamole have no reason to cooperate, and every reason to hate each other. As Runcorn, Harry has no reason to remove Moody's mad eye from Dolores Umbridge's door or to warn Arthur Weasley that he's being watched. But Harry does have reason to do these things, and so he, as Runcorn, does them. As Catamol, Ron has reason to accompany his wife to her hearing, but he doesn't do this. Ron and Harry act according to their own reasons, not according to the reasons of Runcorn and Catamol. So why would Padfoot act for doggy reasons rather than for Sirius's reasons? Framing the puzzle in terms of reasons moves us no closer to solving it. Finally, reasons have nothing to do with Sirius's tail-chasing behaviour. Dogs don't chase their tails when they're excited because they have reason to do so. They chase their tails when they're excited because, I assume, it's fun or it feels good. Perhaps they do so because they think their tails are foreign objects. But Sirius knows better than that. Similarly, I suspect that Lupin doesn't acquire a reason to attack Harry, Ron, and Hermione when he transforms. Instead, he would attack them because it's in his blood to do so. His reasons would lead him to refrain from attacking them. Any solution to our puzzle in terms of reasons will fail to explain Sirius's and Lupin's behaviours. A step in the right direction. Let's reconsider the distinction between mind and body. In the current context, this distinction suggests an explanatory strategy. Some of our acts can be explained by talking about our minds, about the mental causes of the action. Other actions can be explained by talking about our bodies, about the physical causes of the action. In this light, perhaps the reason Padfoot chases his tail has to do with his having the body of a dog. Not everything that Padfoot does is explained by talking about his, Sirius's, mind. Some of the things he does are properly explained by talking about his doggy body. Consider this alternate history. Suppose that while at Hogwarts, when Sirius had learned that his friend Lupin was a werewolf, and so decided to become an animagus to keep Lupin company when he transformed, Sirius decided to become a bear. Sirius's main concerns would have been met had he been a bear. Bears are different from humans, so the werewolf bites presumably wouldn't infect him while transformed, and a bear would have been powerful enough to keep the werewolf in check. Now, imagine him in Order of the Phoenix, outside for the first time in months. Would he have chased his tail? That seems unlikely. He would have done whatever it is that bears do when they are excited and feeling particularly good. He might have, if Winnie the Pooh is any guide, written a song and indulged in some honey. But as Padfoot, as a dog, he chases his tail. So perhaps the correct explanation of Padfoot's behaviour is that his body is a dog's body, and dogs chase their tails when they're excited. Let's pause for a moment and review the ground we've covered. I started by wondering about certain of Padfoot's behaviours. We might think that transformation is just a really good disguise, that it's like putting on a costume. In that case, Padfoot would actually be Sirius looking like a dog. These behaviours tell us otherwise. They are behaviours that Sirius would never engage in, no matter what clothing he was wearing. So, we can draw one conclusion already. Transformation is not just a really good disguise. Somehow, transformation simply transforms you. But we still wonder, why does Padfoot do these things? One possibility is that the reasons the transformed individual has for acting become the reasons that his chosen embodiment had. In that case, Padfoot would act for a dog's reasons. But some of the things Padfoot does are things that Sirius, the man, but not the dog, has reason to do. So much for that solution. Another possible solution is that Padfoot is part man and part dog. I rejected this solution earlier because it doesn't make sense of Padfoot's human-like behaviours, but perhaps I was too hasty. If we first adopt the theory that some of the things one does can be explained by one's body and some by one's mind, then we can say that dogs' bodies, sometimes chase their tails, and because Padfoot has a dog's body, he chases his tail. Let's push a bit deeper here. This theory brings with it other costs and commitments, some of which we may not like. According to this theory, we're able to explain the oddities in Padfoot's behaviour because he has a dog's body. Presumably, Padfoot's having a dog's body explains his behaviour, because for animals, the physical body sometimes trumps reason. That seems odd to me. Perhaps you think that some animals, including dogs, don't reason very well, or don't do things for reasons. So, for them, talk of the reasons for their behaviour is misplaced. If that's what you think, then you think that the things those animals do is best explained by facts about their bodies. But how could this explain Padfoot's behaviour? He has a mind, a human mind, and we think that some of the things he does, he performs as a consequence of having this mind, such as standing on his hind legs when saying goodbye to Harry at King's Cross Station. What is it about having the body of a dog that apparently makes it hard for Sirius to control that body? Consider as well what we have to say to fully explain Padfoot's behaviour. Remember, the idea here is that some behaviour is caused by one's mind and some by one's body. Because Padfoot is a dog, he chases his tail, as dogs do. But why do dogs chase their tails? Presumably, because it feels good. But what could feeling good mean in this case? To whom does it feel good? Does it feel good to Sirius, the human being? I doubt it. Sirius never chases his tail. Does it feel good to Padfoot, the dog? It might. After all, it feels good to other dogs to chase their tails. But Padfoot has a human mind. Isn't it in the mind that his feeling resides? If so, then this explanation tells us that Padfoot chases his tail in order to cause good feelings in Sirius's mind. And this is odd because, as we noted, Sirius never chases his own tail, or, for that matter, his own rear end. But if feeling resides in the body, then we have to say that Padfoot's body has reasons for acting as it does, and Padfoot's mind, which is Sirius's mind, has reasons for acting as it does. It's possible, then, that these reasons could clash. Sirius might end up later saying to Harry, "I didn't want to chase my tail. I wanted to walk with you. But my body wanted to chase my tail." This would be quite odd, to say the least. A unified self. So, I don't think this theory, that minds and bodies are distinct, and that some of the things one does can be explained by one's mind, and other things by one's body, is a good explanation for Padfoot's odd behaviour. The problem, I think, stems from the way the theory invites us to think about minds and bodies. I've been talking about the relation between Sirius's mind and his body, as Padfoot, in a way that comes naturally when we adopt this distinction, that the mind directs the body like a captain directing a ship. That is, that they are wholly distinct entities, and the mind must somehow bring the body to obey its will. This is what it feels like sometimes. For example, athletes talk of asking their bodies to run faster or jump higher. But even Descartes, the author of this distinction, rejects this way of thinking about the relation between mind and body. "I am not only lodged in my body, like a pilot in his ship, but besides, I am joined to it very closely, and indeed so compounded and intermingled with my body that I form, as it were, a single whole with it." Even Descartes, that is, rejects the idea that the body and the mind are completely distinct. They are interwoven entities, not distinct, but really a unit, so that details about one have an effect on the other. Think of how you feel when you are sick, or how you felt when you were learning to ride your bike. The physical state of your body has a direct effect on how you think about the world, on the state of your mind. I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that your body has a direct effect on who you are. How can this be? Let me draw your attention to a couple of details from Deathly Hallows. First, when Ron, Harry and Hermione take the Polyjuice potion and sneak into the Ministry of Magic, Harry is now in the body of Runcorn, a much larger and more physically intimidating man than Harry. He proceeds to act in un-Harry-like ways. He thunders with a powerful voice, dominating the atrium and causing the wizards there to freeze. He also punches a wizard with an enormous fist. What's noteworthy here is not that Harry Runcorn's body is large, and so has the enormous fist and the powerful voice that naturally go with a large man. What's noteworthy is that these are Harry's acts, done for Harry's reasons. Remember, Runcorn is in league with the Death Eaters, but the acts are natural only in Runcorn's body. In his own body, Harry wouldn't have thundered stop. He might have yelled it, but he probably would have chosen some other, more productive action, given that his voice doesn't convey the same power that Runcorn's does. Nor would striking the wizard seem to be such an obvious choice. These are the right choices for Harry to make in this situation, given Harry's reasons and Runcorn's body. Contrast this with a detail that, I suggest, Rowling gets wrong. When Harry transforms into Runcorn, he judges, from his well-muscled arms, that he is powerfully built. My suspicion is that Harry would feel powerfully built. He would have no need to observe his well-muscled arms in order to judge that he is powerfully built. On the other hand, Rowling's descriptions of Harry's feelings in other similar situations, such as the natural feeling he has when submerged in the lake after he eats gillyweed, are spot on. Second, even though Harry has taken Polyjuice Potion before Bill Weasley and Fleur Delacour's wedding, Luna Lovegood is able to recognize him. She sees Harry in Barney Weasley's facial expression. This shouldn't be possible if there is a distinction between Harry's mind and Barney's body. Barney's facial expression should be his own. They should be the facial expressions his body makes, even when it's Harry's mind that's causing them. Consider this thought experiment. Suppose we were able to hook up your brain to someone else's body so that your brain, your thoughts, controlled the other person's body. Likewise, the sensory inputs that the body receives would be relayed to your brain. Then suppose we tell you, via the other person, a shocking secret, but one that the other person already knew. What will happen? First, you will be surprised, but your host will not be surprised. Second, your host's face will register the surprise that you feel, not the surprise that your host feels, for she is not surprised. Will that face look like your face surprised? No, it's not your face. It will look like your host's face surprised. Friends of your host will remark on this. Why does Mary look surprised? She knew such and such already. They won't wonder why Mary is making that peculiar expression, your surprised expression, because Mary won't be making that expression. She'll be making her normal surprised expression. But when Harry transforms into Barney, Barney's expression becomes Harry's. Similarly, when Harry and Ron run into Arthur Weasley while infiltrating the Ministry of Magic, Harry realizes that Ron is not looking his father in the eyes, for fear that his father will recognize him if he does so. The first scenario is an example of one's new body affecting how one thinks and acts. The second is an example of one's mind affecting how one's new body looks. I'm suggesting that the mind and the body of the transformed person is a unified whole, not a pairing of discrete elements. Otherwise, we cannot make sense of the behaviours in which the transformed person engages. Does this help with understanding Padfoot's behaviours? It seems that it does. Padfoot is neither man nor dog, but a combination of the two. So he chases his tail because it feels good, as do other dogs. What about Crouch and Moody? One thing we might notice about Animagi and werewolves is that they become different kinds of beings when they transform. It's no wonder that some of Padfoot's behaviours are odd. When he behaves like a human, he's doing odd things for a dog. And when he behaves like a dog, his behaviour is odd for a human. When someone uses Polyjuice to transform, however, he or she remains human. And so that person's body doesn't engage in such odd behaviour. But I'll bet that some behaviours that didn't feel right before would feel right after transforming. Think about the transformations we muggles undergo. Activities that felt right before we lost a lot of weight feel odd afterward, and vice versa. Riding a bike feels alien and awkward until one learns how, and then it feels like the most natural thing in the world. We do things that change our bodies, and as a result, we change how we interact with the world. When we change our bodies in this way, we are at root changing who we are. I think at least part of the explanation for Crouch's behaviour when he is moody is that certain actions just feel right for him. Crouch, moody, is like Padfoot, and like the rest of us, an indivisible whole made up of mind and body, both of which contribute to the identity of the whole. So, is Sirius a man or a dog? That depends on what he looks like. When he looks like a man, he's a man. When he looks like a dog, he's neither. Padfoot, Sirius when he looks like a dog, is a third kind of thing, reducible to neither a dog nor a man. He's a unique kind of being, a man-dog, that combines features of both humans and dogs. This view, I claim, makes the most sense of Rowling's text and accords well with our best contemporary theories of the self. As Descartes said, mind and body truly do form a single whole. The nature of this entity is determined by both one's mind and one's body, even if one's body happens to be the body of a dog. Chapter 3. Destiny in the Wizarding World. Jeremy Pierce. The Potter stories portray Professor Sybil Trelawney, Hogwarts divination teacher, as an old fraud, whose soothsaying comes in pseudo-scientific trappings. She teaches various techniques for predicting the future, including tea leaves, planetary orbits, palm reading, dream interpretation, tarot cards, and crystal balls. Each method has rules for students to follow, but they have little scientific basis. Trelawney's predictions often turn out wrong, such as her constantly repeated forecast of Harry's premature death. She also accepts others' fabricated predictions that fit her preconceived ideas. For example, when she awards Harry and Ron Weasley top marks for predicting tragic misfortunes in their immediate futures. Nevertheless, at least two of Trelawney's prophecies are different. Professor Dumbledore calls them her only two real predictions. Normally, Trelawney speaks in such elastic generalities about common enough occurrences that she'll usually find something that fits. A science-minded muggle, like Vernon Dursley, might reject divination as a reliable predictor. What do the alignments of the planets and the random assignment of tarot cards in a deck have to do with the processes that lead to certain events happening rather than others? But this is a magical world, even if the Dursleys don't like it. Couldn't magic connect tea leaves or dreams with actual future events? Unfortunately, Trelawney usually comes across as a complete fraud, and her usual methods are probably either non-magical or unreliable magic. Professor McGonagall tells Harry's class that divination is one of the most imprecise branches of magic. I shall not conceal from you that I have very little patience with it. True seers are very rare. And Professor Trelawney? She stopped short to avoid speaking ill of a colleague, but the point is clear. Sybil Trelawney isn't a true seer. Similarly, the Centaur Firenze distinguishes between Trelawney and genuine seers. Sybil Trelawney may have seen, I do not know, but she wastes her time in the main on the self-flattering nonsense humans call fortune-telling. He respects and practices prophecy, despite acknowledging its fallibility, but he distinguishes it from the nonsense of fortune-telling. That raises a question about genuine prophecies. What does it mean to say they're real? And how are they different from the others? Even Dumbledore, skeptical about most divination, acknowledges two of Trelawney's predictions as different. And Firenze also admits the possibility. So, what is this distinction? Varieties of prophecy. Do real predictions derive from what will actually happen? Is the future fixed so that there's just one future? Aristotle, 384 to 322 BCE, gets credit for first raising this issue. Is it true when Harry first attends Hogwarts that he'll have a final face-off with Voldemort 7 years later? If the future is fixed, there's only one future, and it will happen. This isn't to say that it will happen no matter what anyone does. It could happen because of what they do. And if they did something else, a different future would happen. But part of the fixed future is what they'll do. Being fixed also doesn't necessarily mean the future is predetermined. People who believe the future is fixed may not be determinists, although some are. prophecies can be fallible or infallible. An infallible prophecy is guaranteed to be true. It couldn't have been wrong. By contrast, fallible prophecies could be wrong. False prophecies are fallible because they're actually wrong. But true prophecies can also be fallible. All it takes is possibly getting it wrong. Fallibility isn't about how sure we can be of whether a prophecy will come true. I might be very unsure of an infallible prophecy if I don't understand its secure basis. I might be very sure of a fallible prophecy, even a false one, if I lack crucial facts. Exactly how does a seer gain access to information in a prophecy? Here are several possibilities. 1. A prophecy might be a fallible prediction based on human observations through the five senses. Muggle weather reports and Trelawney's prophecies are like this. 2. If the future isn't fixed, all of the information in the universe wouldn't be enough to guarantee a correct prediction, but there might be enough to expect probabilities. Perhaps the seer gains access to possible or likely futures. Maybe Trelawney sees possible futures but can't discern the most likely ones and must speak in vague generalities. Dumbledore says, "The consequences of our actions are always so complicated, so diverse, that predicting the future is a very difficult business indeed." Professor Trelawney, bless her, is living proof of that. 3. A prophecy might be a fallible prediction based on a limited understanding of a deterministic world. If the future is predetermined by the current state of the world and the laws of nature, and the seer has imperfect access to it through signs of what causes it, then the seer views a fixed future. Magic derives information from the natural forces that lead to that future, but it may not give perfect information. Or the seer might magically behold a fixed future without interpreting it correctly, perhaps because of partial information. 4. A soothsayer may be skilled at using predictions to make people do things. Such a seer could influence people by knowing how an audience is likely to respond to a prophecy. As we'll see shortly, Dumbledore thinks Trelawney's first real prediction led Voldemort to choose Harry to kill, marking Harry as his equal. Trelawney didn't intend anything, but the prophecy plays a role in its own fulfillment. 5. An infallible prediction might come from a complete understanding of the deterministic processes that guarantee an outcome. This would need an all-knowing being or magical forces influenced by deterministic processes. 6. An infallible prediction might come from infallible access to the actual future. This might be by magic or through someone who has direct contact with the future, perhaps a divine being or a person with cross-time communication. Or a seer might have the ability to see into the actual future, not merely into possible futures. 7. Finally, a prophecy could combine fallibility and infallibility, with infallible access to some fixed fact about the future and fallibility about another aspect. The fallibility might come either from imperfect access to a fixed fact or from information about likely futures. So, the question before us is what kind of prophecy Professor Trelawney's genuine prophecies are, as opposed to her usual fortune-telling. Fallible prophecies. Most of Trelawney's predictions are perfect examples of the first category. Fallible predictions based on sensory experience. They're usually vague or open-ended enough to find something to fit them, but there may be no guarantee, and it won't always fit well. It's easy to see how general prophecies might at best be only probable, even if some are very likely. Trelawney's predictions don't come from an infallible source, but from her ability to predict likely enough things, sometimes based on background information. Many of her predictions are easy to fulfill. Others may happen to be right by accident. Some are false, such as her forecasts of Harry's imminent death. Dumbledore seems to treat all prophecies as fallible when he tells Harry that the first of Trelawney's real prophecies didn't have to come true. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches. Born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies. And the Dark Lord will mark him as his equal. but he will have power the Dark Lord knows not, and either must die at the hand of the other, for neither can live while the other survives. Dumbledore suggests to Harry that some prophecies turn out to be false.
Do you think every prophecy in the Hall of Prophecy has been fulfilled?
He continues,
The prophecy does not mean you have to do anything. In other words, you are free to choose your way, quite free to turn your back on the prophecy.
Voldemort's obsession with the prophecy will lead him to seek out Harry, and as a result, they'll almost certainly face off, but not because this was fated by the prophecy. So, prophecies can vary in likelihood. Is that the distinguishing factor between real predictions and Trelawney's usual sayings? Some are likely to be true because they're based on her perceptions of what tends to happen, and she makes them vague enough to be likely. Others are more genuine because they're more likely. This is a difference of degree. They're both matters of likelihood, although some are more likely. But when Dumbledore treats two prophecies as special, doesn't it seem as if they're more special than that? Indeed, there's still something different about them. The two real predictions were purely involuntary and have a magical source. They aren't Category 1, which involves actively paying attention. Trelawney must have had a stronger connection with the future, an occasional ability to connect with an actual fixed future, Category 3, or possible futures, Category 2. There are also some indications that Professor Trelawney has inconsistent access to the future, or to possible futures, even when conscious. Consider the following example, when Harry is heading to his first private lesson with Dumbledore in Half-Blood Prince. Harry proceeded through deserted corridors, though he had to step hastily behind a statue when Professor Trelawney appeared around a corner, muttering to herself as she shuffled a pack of dirty-looking playing cards, reading them as she walked.
Two of spades. Conflict, she murmured, as she passed the place where Harry crouched, hidden. Seven of spades, an ill omen. Ten of spades, violence. Knave of spades, a dark young man, possibly troubled. One who dislikes the questioner.
She stopped dead, right on the other side of Harry's statue.
Well, that can't be right, she said, annoyed.
And Harry heard her reshuffling vigorously as she set off again, leaving nothing but a whiff of cooking sherry behind her. What she says could easily apply to Harry, but she has no inkling of his presence. Is that likely to be a coincidence? Harry encounters her again on his way to his last appointment with Dumbledore before they leave for Voldemort's cave.
If Dumbledore chooses to ignore the warnings the cards show...
Her bony hand closed suddenly around Harry's wrist.
Again and again, no matter how I lay them out...
And she pulled a card dramatically from underneath her shawls.
The lightning struck tower, she whispered. Calamity. Disaster. Coming nearer all the time.
This is so vague that it might just be Category 1, but the tower is significant in light of the book's finale, which not only includes Dumbledore's death, but even leads to a bigger disaster as the Death Eaters seize power. Self-fulfilling prophecies. Dumbledore suggests that Trelawney's first real prediction might be self-fulfilling. He tells Harry,
It may not have meant you at all.
Because Neville Longbottom had been born a day earlier, and his parents had also thrice defied Voldemort. But then a few paragraphs later, he tells Harry,
There is no doubt that it is you.
Because Voldemort's choice to go after Harry rather than Neville led to his making Harry as his equal. According to Dumbledore's interpretation, the prophecy didn't itself determine whether it was about Harry or Neville. Voldemort's choice of Harry made it true of Harry. He wouldn't have attacked Harry had there not been a prophecy, and so the prophecy led him to fulfill that part of itself.